Thank you for listening to the Dan Time Podcast. Today, we celebrate Dan Bankhead. He was born Daniel Robert Bankhead on May 3rd, 1920, in Empire, Alabama, the middle of five brothers and one of nine siblings. U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Congressional Gold Medal Sergeant, Dan Bankhead was the very first African-American pitcher in Major League Baseball, making his debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers on August 26, 1947 at Ebbets Field. In December 2020, Major League Baseball officially designated the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948 as Major League status. Prior to his debut in Brooklyn, Dan was a top pitcher for the Birmingham Black Barons and the Memphis Red Sox from 1940 to 1947. All five of the Bankhead brothers played baseball at the highest level. Dan Bankhead was known as one of the better hitting pitchers and an all-around superstar for the Dodgers' AAA affiliate, the Montreal Royals. Satchel Paige compared the velocity on Dan's fastball to that of Hall of Famer Bob Feller. Dan Bankhead was a league leader in strikeouts multiple times across his long baseball career, a four-time All-Star in pro ball, a no-hitter to his credit. While on leave from the Marines, he pitched a three-hit shutout with 17 strikeouts in June 1944 at Yankee Stadium against the New York Black Yankees. Dan was also a 20-game winner in back-to-back seasons with Nashua in 1948 and Montreal in 1949. In a must-win Game 6 of the 1947 World Series, Dan scored as a pinch runner in the top of the sixth as Brooklyn took an 8-5 lead and went on to win the game. From 1955 to 1966, Dan Bankhead played and managed for a number of teams across Mexico, Canada, and Latin America. And today, we're going to bring his story to life with Roy Costello of the Society for American Baseball Research, also known as SABRE. Roy is chief editor and co-chairman of the Bio Project Committee. Roy has written many dozens of biographies as part of the Bio Project, as well as game project stories, several Sabre Journal articles, research topics, stories on ballparks, as well as Twilight at Ebbets Field. Ballplayers from Hawaii are another one of his pet topics, but Roy has covered players from 20 different nations or territories, including 11 places in Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, before we get to the conversation, the Danversation here, let me say this episode would not have been possible without the help of Doc Settles, decorated U.S. Air Force veteran and Mid-Ohio award-winning artist. When he was a teenager, Doc was fortunate to share many special encounters with Dan Bankhead. He told me, "My love and admiration for a beloved mentor, friend, family relative by marriage, and Marine baseball trailblazer has never wavered. Doc's incredible 18x24-inch watercolor drawing of Bankhead will soon be displayed at the Birmingham and Jasper, Alabama, VA Medical and Community Care Centers. This action portrait of Dan Bankhead has also been featured in Alabama Heritage Magazine. I am hopeful in the next few weeks to continue the Dan Bankhead story with Doc Settles. You can find him and follow him on Facebook at Doc Settles Art. I appreciate you listening to the show. Tell a friend about it. At Dan Time Pod. And here it is, my Danversation with Roy Costello. Folks, it is Dan Bankhead time.
Oh, it's Dan time. Grab a seat, it's Dan time. Yeah, it's Dan time. Only Dan's on the line.
Roy Costello, it is a pleasure to bring you onto the Dan Time Podcast.
Glad to be here with you this evening, Dan.
Thank you so much for joining me. Folks, Roy has written dozens of biographies on past and present ball players. He's an alumnus of Williams College. He's also written Twilight at Ebbets Field. This was particularly interesting to me, going back to the game of baseball and all the mysteries of baseball. You want to know what happened? What happened after this event happened? And one of the major events in baseball history, of course, the Brooklyn Dodgers heading west and I believe it was 1957. So Twilight at Ebbets Field, that is a chapter of stadium lore, as it's described on Sabre.org, S-A-B-R.org, revealing what exactly happened in those few years before the wrecking ball hit Ebbets Field. Ball players from Hawaii are another pet topic, but he's covered players from 20 different nations or territories. Roy, can you give the listeners here a little background on your involvement with Sabre and your love for the game of baseball?
Sure. Well, originally I was a member in the early 90s, and then I really got more active in the late 1990s after engaging in a project on history of the baseball in the Virgin Islands. And so I actually, because that was when I was a kid, I remember looking at collecting baseball cards and noticing that the likes of Horace Clark and Elrod Hendricks had been born in the Virgin Islands and made it to the major leagues. And I thought, oh, wow, I want to cover an area that's never been touched on before. And that was the opening to writing about, you know, these guys from the Virgin Islands who made it to the majors. It was just quite a little wellspring of talent in the 60s and 70s in particular.
Roy, can you imagine, or most people listening, can you guys imagine what the game of baseball would be like without the influx of Latin American talent? If you just completely take those ball players out and it's just a white man sport and nothing ever really changes, wow, the landscape would be obviously completely altered.
Oh, obviously, yeah. It would be so much poorer without the influx of talent from all the different dimensions. I mean, you can, that's been one of my favorite things about writing for Sabre, is just the influx of players from different nationalities and backgrounds. Pacific Islanders, you know, as you mentioned earlier, my interest in ball players from Hawaii. But I've written like about 19 or 20 different countries of origin for baseball players in the major leagues.
Well, Roy, our subject today, I'm so excited, not just because he's named Dan. I'm always a fan of the underdog. I'm always a fan of the underrepresented, particularly somebody like our subject today, somebody that's been gone a long time, and even in the waning years of his life, you know, which I think he spent in Houston. To my knowledge, nobody from the Houston Chronicle had the foresight to say, hey, let's go sit down with this guy and capture some of his memories. And maybe there was some responsibility on both ends where just not getting the story out there. But I feel like if he was here today, maybe he would appreciate that we're painting some color on his life and his career. Folks, the first African-American pitcher in Major League Baseball. Now, of course, at the end of 2020, the Negro Leagues were officially recognized as the Major Leagues. But widely recognized or correctly recognized after Jackie Robinson, the very first position player to appear in a major league uniform. Dan Bankhead, 1947, makes his debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Talk about, Roy, your interest in Dan Bankhead and how the paths crossed for you to research and write about Dan.
Well, Sabre does a number of book projects. It's been an ongoing theme with Sabre to write project books of biographies of every member of a major league team who's played for a significant squad over the years. And the 1947 Dodgers were a pennant-winning team. And they didn't win the World Series, but they did win the National League pennant. And Sabre decided to devote a book in collaboration with the University of Nebraska Press on biographies of every member of the 1947 Dodgers. And they offered up the choice to select who you wanted to write about. And I chose Dan Bankhead just because he was kind of offbeat and not well recognized and deserved further recognition.
Now, as I understand it, in August of 1947, the Brooklyn Dodgers are still in the pennant chase with, I believe, was it St. Louis?
Yeah.
And so there was a need, and I think there was another player we may talk about in a minute, another pitcher who had a problem playing with black teammates or with Jackie or something of that nature. And so Branch Rickey kind of has to spring into action and go find I don't know if it was done with tremendous haste, but to pull somebody else up from the minor league system. And maybe had there been more of a gap, maybe they're up six, seven, eight games or 10 games, it's a completely different story. But Dan Bankhead more or less is rushed to the majors, which I don't know if he had much more than 3 or 4 days notice or less than that.
I agree with your assessment. It was hasty. It was done on the fly.
And he's really at that time, and we'll talk about his time with the Birmingham Black Barons, but he's really lighting it up. He's arguably, I think he is the top pitcher for the Memphis Red Sox, the AAA Red Sox there, and gets the call up to the big leagues. But important to keep in mind here, sports psychology is a long way from evolution and teams having these robust departments. Anybody listening, go to the Milwaukee Brewers or Texas Rangers website, any team's website, and just scroll and scroll and scroll through the personnel. It's changed a good deal over the years. And so at that time, there's really nobody to help this kid out, which I don't know. I think he's 20, maybe 23 years old.
Well, let me see. But it actually would have been sort of mid to late 20s.
That's right. I'm sorry, 27. But Dan has, he's gotten Bob Feller comparisons, as you wrote, Roy, and they kind of needed somebody, I guess, to compliment or to room with and eat with Jackie Robinson and be kind of a buddy for Jackie.
Well, it just seemed like that was the perception among the front office at the time, that the black guys needed another black guy as support.
Backing up a little bit here, because this is very significant. Dan Bankhead is kind of the middle brother of a group of five boys who all end up playing Major League Baseball, or what's recognized as Major League Baseball present day. He's got, I think, the oldest, Sam Bankhead, then Fred Bankhead, then Dan, Joe, and there's a Garnett Jr. There's also, interestingly enough, some of the dates here are questionable, but looks like he had, or his parents had, two toddlers who unfortunately died, around 2, 3, 4 years old, a boy and a girl, and then a sister, Mildred, which, looking at the dates, Dan Bankhead born May 3rd, 1920. All of his brothers, a little bit of a age difference there. He's about 5 to 10 years younger than Sam, maybe 8 years younger than Fred, maybe 5 years older than Joe, and so forth. But he's pretty close there with Mildred. I'd love to know what their relationship was like. But Dan's father, Garnett Sr., played in the, I had this written down, the Cotton League.
Well, I believe there was a tie-in with the coal industry in Alabama, too.
Because I think you saw this in your research as well, where the family was in Sullivan, Alabama. Well, some of those, the first children are born, then they move to Empire, Alabama, a little bit closer to Birmingham. Probably, I'm sure, driven by the father's work opportunities.
Yeah, I can't say that I focused a great deal on the family aspects beyond what I was able to just present the facts as I knew them or as I was able to discover them. I didn't look into the family dynamics or anything like that. But what was interesting was that a few years after I published the bio, there was a piece in the New York Times that focused on Dan Bankhead. I think it was from around 2012. And it was written by another guy from Williams College, Michael Beschloss, a presidential historian. And he actually mentioned my bio and even just speculated on the possibility or just the ties with Bankhead's family's slave holdings and Tallulah Bankhead, the actress.
Doc talks about, we may bounce around a little bit here on the timeline or with some anecdotes about Dan. The photos of Dan Bankhead that are available, Roy, represents that kind of youthful joy. He looks like a guy that you'd want to sit down and talk to, play catch with, pick his brain. He looks like he would be approachable. You've quoted Doc here, and your writing is saying he had a personality that you wanted to be around. He left you with positive things. I was able to enjoy his laughter and his jokes and his smiles. I just wish we knew more about what he went through as an African-American baseball trailblazer.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more, because Doc Settles, whom you've just mentioned, he was the one who shined a light on Dan's final years when he'd fallen into obscurity. But it was an essential piece of writing a biography that covered his full life. And I was just fortunate to be able to find somebody who actually knew Dan in those years and was able to shine a light on what his life was like.
And Doc is a remarkably gifted painter and artist. We'll, of course, include his artwork in connection with this episode. How did you find Doc Settles, and what were your interactions with Doc like in learning more about Bankhead?
Well, I just must have done some Googling and just seen some posts that he had on some website or another about Dan. And so it contained an email address, and I dropped him a line and he responded. And it was like that ever since. We've been in touch. And I've never had the actual good fortune to speak with Doc on the telephone, but we've always had a very friendly email correspondence.
Now, one thing I appreciate, Roy, is if you go out to like baseballreference.com, and you look at his major league statistics here, it'll show you about 9 years, 1940 to 51, starting with the Birmingham Black Barons and, of course, the Brooklyn years. And then it sort of drops off. And I know you can filter here for other leagues, minor and Mexican league stats. But there's like almost arguably a richer story, or the details, the little nuggets that we know about Dan from that time spent bouncing around in Puerto Rico, Mexico, and other locales. How fascinating was that to you? And can you talk about what you uncovered from that portion?
Oh yeah, that
of
was
career?
A total eye opener for me. That was, I thought, maybe the richest dimension of Dan's story, about how even after he'd faded from the major league scene, he kept knocking around in these other leagues until well into his 40s. And just you, I would, because one of the perks of Sabre is that you have access to the archives of the Sporting News for free. And if you just do a search on Dan Bankhead in the Sporting News archives, you'll see that he'll pop up with little headshots and just mentions of his doings, you know, 50s, 60s, just many, many years, just through Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Mexico, especially Mexico.
I noticed, and this jumped out at me as well, he's one of only four pitchers, and maybe that's changed, where his very first appearance with the Brooklyn Dodgers, 1947, in that game against Pittsburgh, he comes into a dirty inning, I think, but when it's his time to hit, he hits a home run in his very first at bat.
Oh, yeah.
Not the cleanest pitching line, but a pretty cool distinction there. And then something it kind of sparked some curiosity, you know, how's the guy able to do that? He just got called up. He's, as he described it, you know, everything felt tight. Everything felt, you know, it's like when you have a new pair of cleats and you look nice, but nothing's broken in and you're just a little rigid. But then he's able to power one over the fence with all that nervous energy. But I was looking at some of the stats that you bring to life in his post-major league career in the batting averages. Not always a power hitter, but you know, he played more in the field.
He played a lot of first base. Mm-hmm. He could swing the stick, for sure.
It got me wondering, of course, going back to the beginning here, what if he doesn't get called up in August? What if he doesn't come into a situation like that where the starter's been yanked? What if he starts in April of 1948? A lot of what ifs with a lot of players, quite frankly, but it seemed like the love of the game of baseball propelled him to just continue his path. And, you know, take a look at his stats in 1950. He wins his first four decisions, or first four starts, I believe. You know, I found it fascinating. His wife, Linda, a jazz singer with the great Fletcher Henderson's orchestra. He has a daughter with her, which Lulu may have been a foster child. We're not sure. I love this part of your writing, Dan, Roy. Again, going back to the type of guy he was, Linda, young Lulu, maybe she's about 9 years old, the dog Tacky, and a pet chicken named Fanny Chichi, all hop in a car, presumably, to join Dan in Brooklyn, driving up from Memphis, I'm guessing. And she's followed him from Chicago. All these thoughts going through my mind, you know, of what that situation's like. And Linda follows him for several years.
Yeah, because I talked with Dan's son William and about that, and it seems like it was just very complex, and there were a lot of cross currents going on with that relationship, and Dan in general with his dealings with the women in his life.
Yeah, one thing want to make clear, because it's easy to gloss over really anybody. It could be a celebrity, an actor, actress, ball players. We all have our personal lives, and Dan, there's some things that may have occurred in the later part of his life and Mexico or Latin America that weren't maybe the healthiest personal choices or relationship choices. But he does seem like he certainly got as much as he could out of his playing career. After that first game in 1947, August 47, Dan said, quote, "I think I'll be okay as soon as this newness wears off. Today seems like, again, I was, as I referenced, I was wearing a new glove, new shoes, new hat. Everything seemed tight." Wondering about his background, I grew up in Birmingham. I probably cut it off on the video here, but the Birmingham Barons ball cap here. I've been to a number of games and the Rickwood Classic, but I didn't grow up, obviously, in the same time period as Dan. Do you think, Roy, that there was an inclination, because I think he and Jackie both commented, maybe in Winter League ball, that they were very well received by the Latin American fans, and just a desire to move on from, what's happening and really across the United States in those early 1950s, and just go play ball where you're not being harassed every second of the day. You can go eat places and.
Well, I think that was just a long-running theme of for Negro Leaguers, was that life was a whole lot easier and more comfortable in Latin America.
Because I looked at some of the rosters on those first teams in the Mexican leagues, and like Dan is the only American, and presumably he had to learn the language on the fly, which, from what I understand, towards the end of his life, he was very fluent in Spanish.
It sounded that way, yeah. But I don't know, it just seemed like the impression I got was that Dan didn't have the same equipment, just the tenacity mentally that Jackie Robinson had to deal with the racial BS in the US.
Yeah. And the first outing, and I told myself I wasn't going to just hone in on that first outing, because there's, he was a 20-game winner in AAA a couple different times, I believe. But when you're from Empire, Alabama, you've played at Rickwood Field, just traveling around the South and stuff and the things you go through. I think he hit a batter in that first trip on the mound. And that's got to really, at that period of time, I think we forget how. It's got to make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. If you're somebody like a young Dan Bankhead, you just drilled a white player, and you don't know what the repercussions are going to be.
Yeah, it could have been trouble.
Yeah. You got to make it through that game. You got to make it out of the ballpark. You also wonder what it's like when you go back to the dugout. What are the conversations like between Dan and Jackie? You think Jackie's saying, "Hey, hang in there, kid"?
Well, the impression I got was that Jackie and Dan Bankhead weren't the best of buddies. There was a funny line where Bankhead said to Robinson, probably circa 1950 or thereabouts, "Not only are you wrong, Robinson, you are loud wrong."
I did seem to. I'm glad you described that, because I couldn't find a lot that talked about the warmth of their friendship. It seemed like it was more of a manufactured pairing, where they may not have had a whole lot in common.
If I had to guess, I don't think they were friends.
But maybe Newcomb and Bankhead a little more closely aligned, possibly.
Possibly. Or maybe Campanella too.
Now, I understand you spoke with Dan's son William in part of your research. Was William happy to talk about his father and everything he remembered from his perspective?
Yeah, he was. He was a quirky guy, but he was an interesting guy. I haven't been, well, it's going back a long way since I did this research. It must have been like around 2007 where I wrote this article.
Yeah.
And so I haven't been in touch with William Bankhead for since then. And that's going on 20 years now. Although there was another son, Dan Bankhead Jr., who renamed himself. I guess he embraced Islam and became known as Dan Al-Mateen. I never actually did reach that guy.
Oh, wow.
I tried, but I didn't get any response.
I tried to do some research or Googling on Lulu and really came up blank. There just didn't seem to be a lot there. Or I know Linda's probably long since deceased as well.
Yeah.
Here we are coming up on the 50-year anniversary of Dan Bankhead's passing at the rather young age of 56. But this was due to lung cancer. I don't know if he was a 2 or 3 pack-a-day smoker. I know that smoking was very common across all the leagues at that time.
Well, that was something that Doc Settles described too. It was just Dan and his cigarette habit.
Yeah. You report on Dan spending his final years working as for a small service company delivering food, goods, and supplies to small businesses and restaurants across Houston. And I think this is Doc's recollection where he would go actually pick up Dan Bankhead from a small apartment, and he'd have a glove and a ball, and he'd be smoking a Camel, going back to what you were saying. But he actually got to play catch. Doc got to play catch with Dan Bankhead and still said he had a lot of zip on that fastball.
That's right. Yeah, I could imagine him just shaking his hand when he was receiving Dan's fastball.
Quite remarkable that, you know, you hear of players who were the first. Obviously, Jackie Robinson, and then Bankhead is the first pitcher. Most people, casual fans, might be surprised that it was like a full decade for other franchises to bring in their first black ball player. This wasn't like it just opened the floodgates.
Yeah, there have been books written about that, too. There was one called Crossing the Line that detailed the history of franchise by franchise of how long it took for players to make it with certain franchises. And the Red Sox were at their bringing up the rear.
Now, Roy, could you talk a little bit about, before we get way too deep in the episode here, because I want to shine the light on the bio project with Sabre. And how do you go about accepting submissions? Do people reach out? And I'm sure you have some people who'd say, hey, I'd love to contribute. And then they turn in a sample and you can't do a whole lot with it. Does that happen? Or do people have to meet certain criteria?
Yeah, for sure. Well, the first thing is that you have to be a member in good standing of Sabre. And then we have FAQs up on the website, just what the basics are that are expected of a Sabre bio project story. And then, well, one of the things that I deal with as chief editor is that a lot of people want to write, but not many people who want to review and edit. And so there's a bottleneck, and that we have to do the best we can with the resources we have. We're trying to get all the stories published by people who want to publish.
And this is straight from the website as well. The Baseball Biography Project is one of the society's major undertakings. It collects biographies of all players and managers who have appeared in Major League Baseball, as well as a number of other persons of significance in baseball history. So this might be a broadcaster. Do you include umpires?
Yeah, there are umpires. We have one of our authors who has a specialty in umpires and likes to write about them. So yeah, umps are definitely part of the picture. Executives, broadcasters, it covers a wide range.
How about, and this may sound a little quirky, but I'm a Chicago Cub fan, and I remember Yosh Kawana, the longtime clubhouse manager. Would you cover somebody like that?
Potentially. As long as he had impact on the game, it's fair game for the bio project.
Other significant projects include the Sabre Games Project and the Sabre Oral History Collection.
Yeah, the Games Project is something that is just, it runs in parallel with the bio project. And in many ways, it's actually become more popular among writers just because they're shorter pieces and you can knock them out more quickly.
Folks, if you're interested, if you've heard of the Society for American Baseball Research, better known as Sabre, and also if you've ever wondered, if you've heard about Sabre metrics, Sabre metricians, where did that come from? It's derived from the Society's name. But if your curiosity has been piqued today and you've loved the game for a long time and you just want to be a part of it, go out to sabre.org, sabr.org, and also on the website, check out the regional chapters. There's a really good chance that there's something, if you live in a large metro area, there almost certainly will be a regional chapter where you live, and if you live within an hour of one, there may be one as well. Well, the Brothers Bankhead, you know, we could spin off the family tree here. I think some of the other brothers possibly had some ballplayer children of their own. I'm not sure. But what a... This was something I was thinking about today, and this is off topic a little bit from your research, but going back to Dan's closest sibling in age, Mildred Louise, born in 1922, if all of these boys in the house are talented enough, or become talented enough to play at the highest level of baseball, you got to figure one of these girls would have been a great softball, basketball, pretty good athlete. And I was thinking about that today driving around, that perhaps maybe they did play some level of sports.
It's entirely possible, but it never occurred to me, honestly.
Roy, can you speak a little bit more about Dan and maybe the Birmingham Black Barons and his significance in that, you know, with the Barons' history?
Well, I don't profess to be a real student of the Negro Leagues or possess in-depth knowledge, but obviously he was able to make a splash with that franchise and gain notice at the major league level. And that's about as far as I can tell you. I filled in the basic facts that were available about his time in the Negro Leagues and about his great promise that he displayed in the Negro Leagues, but I really can't tell you a great deal beyond that. Well, one of the other things that I'll just mention too is that he, and it's certainly interesting and pertinent to his life and career, is his time in the Marines in World War II.
Oh, yes.
He was a member of the group called the Montford Point Marines. They weren't an actual battle group, but still were very significant in U.S. military history.
You know, you would have loved to have had Dan or somebody that was very close with Dan sit down with a journalist.
Well, quite simply, I think the boom in Negro Leagues history, just finding the guys from those days and interviewing them and getting them to open up and talk about their lives and experiences. Dan Bankhead just passed away a little too early before he could be part of that whole movement.
That's a very good point. Had he lived to be just 66 or certainly 76,
he'd have been found.
You know, that puts him into the 1990s.
Well, at least the late 70s, early 80s, then he would have been around and he would have been rediscovered. So it really, what it wound up being was just, as I wrote the bio, I was I work in Wall Street, and we have what we call the mosaic theory, which is about how you put together a picture of a company bit by bit, pieces it all together. And so that's what it was like with Dan Bankhead, was just putting together the mosaic one little bit at a time.
And Roy, again, you've researched dozens of ball players. I'm sure you go down these rabbit holes. Do you know when to catch yourself and to say, okay, let's climb out of this one and get back on track? And is that part of the joy of it?
Mm-hmm. Ideally, we like to have these stories told in 4,000 words or less. But in Bankhead's case, there was so much to discover and so much to write about that if I had to guess, I think that one ran around 7,000 words. But we like to keep it big picture. We like to keep it high level. And we don't want to get necessarily all down. One of the things that we find is that people get caught up in statistics, just rattling off the statistics year by year like a laundry list. And that's not what makes an interesting biography. What makes an interesting biography is the person and the history.
Sure. I did want to mention, I didn't realize Tommy Lasorda had spent so much time in Montreal as a ball player and maybe later as an early manager. But I saw that Dan Bankhead and Tommy's paths, I believe, crossed in Montreal.
Probably it would have been in the early mid-50s or thereabouts.
Could you point out a ball player that you've researched outside of a Bankhead here, our subject today, that was your favorite?
Well, if I had a couple of favorites in particular, one of the guys from the Virgin Islands, Al McBean, was just hilarious. He was the funniest man I've ever had, and just the most interesting man I've ever had the good fortune to interview. And he was a pitcher for the Pirates in the 1960s. I'm a Civil War buff as well. I remember it was one of the Civil War historians said the story of the army isn't told by the generals, it's told by the foot soldiers. And I look at the guys who just maybe had short or very modest major league careers, and I think that to me they're a whole lot more interesting than the superstars. And one of the guys in that vein whom I really enjoyed writing about was a guy who played very briefly with the Dodgers in the 1990. His name was Brian Traxler.
Oh, wow. Seemed like I might remember that name, early 90s.
Well, he spent a long time in the minors and in indie ball, too, but he only had a little taste of the majors in just early 1990. But I saw him in one of those major league appearances. He was playing my favorite team, the Mets, and he was just stocky, and he had this intense grimace on his face, and he was just hilarious to look at. I remember telling my buddy whom I was watching the game with, he was out getting a beer or something in the kitchen, and I said, "You got to get in here, check this guy out."
That is certainly what makes following ball players a lot of fun, and as you wisely alluded there, we really like, the casual fan, it's okay, everybody loves the superstars, but big time baseball fans, and especially if you have a team like the Mets or whoever your favorite team is, chances are you love all these underreported, maybe forgotten role players of little, parts of decades, and it makes a lot of fun. A lot of the personalities and the look of some players, some of the mustaches and the hairstyles.
Well, yeah. Well, the 70s and 80s in particular were a rich time for that.
Do you care to comment on the game today and maybe some of the pitch clock and ghost runner and some of the evolutions of the way the game has been sped up? And do you have a comment that you're okay to share on that?
I mean, I can see the goal, what they're trying to achieve, but I don't think the means justify the end.
I still have a problem with the pitch clock. I think maybe most people would say it's been successful, but one of the great things about baseball is that there wasn't a clock.
Well, Earl Weaver had a comment about that, too. He was comparing it to the NFL, and he said you can't just run out the clock in baseball. You have to play it out till the last out.
You have to play it out, and with it being March Madness being upon us, you can't foul to send a team to the line, hope they miss a couple shots and that sort of thing. And all those clock stoppages in other sports, you're right. You've got to plate more runs.
Although I think I remember just before the shot clock came in college basketball, I could not stand North Carolina basketball with the four corners.
I do enjoy this time of year with the tournament coming up. I think with baseball, you just have to accept some of the changes and just appreciate the fact that our favorite game here has the history, that it's wrapped in the rich history and lore that it is. Right when the pandemic hit, 2020, that spring of 2020, there's no ball games on at night. I turned my attention to YouTube, and I would pull up like 1952 Dodgers World Series, and I would just sit and watch an old game, or I'd watch the 1977 All-Star game, or something very random. Did you do anything like that during the pandemic when there wasn't live baseball to watch?
Yeah, well, I just enjoy pulling up the old YouTube clips, and I just like about how simple and basic the presentation of the stats was, and that they didn't feel the need for 3, 4, 5 talking heads.
Right. Oh, yeah. Not every team can have a Vin Scully, but I would put it at 2 max for me in the booth.
That's all you need.
One color guy, one play-by-play guy. Or male or female.
I don't know. It feels like in many ways, baseball has been desperate to just try to compete with video games and just with quick action and quick cuts and overloading the senses. And that the appeal of baseball lies in just its quietness and the lack of need for, you're just, ideally in baseball, you kick back, you relax. You don't have to be bombarded with information.
Yeah, it's always a little disappointing for me during the World Series or, the divisional round or LCS, and you're watching people, that home plate view right behind home plate, and I guess they're running through their emails, or what could be more important at this moment? We all jump on our devices at what looks like inopportune times, but you just see people miss an entire pitch sequence and not taking in, like you said, the, hey, you're at the ballpark. It's hopefully we can break away in our digital world to enjoy all the, just the ambiance of the ballpark. But yeah, I see that, particularly in the postseason, it's really hard to watch.
Yeah.
But Roy, this has been really special to have you on today, and I can't thank you enough for the time to
my pleasure, Dan,
to help me introduce people possibly to Dan Bankhead. It's, you know, it is what it is. He didn't make the big splash, but he is forever known as the first black pitcher to take the mound, to toe the rubber. And I think you may have written in your writing here that he had a way of really stomping on that rubber.
Oh, yeah, that, I do remember that aspect of it now, too. But yeah, we don't have video, so I don't know. It's hard to describe without actually having the video there to absorb it and what it was like seeing him on the mound.
Well, I hope we can do another episode at some date in the future. You're always welcome here on the podcast, even if we talk about a non-Dan, because part of the show being Dan Time with the clocks.
The guy who occurred to me you should look into is Dan Boone, the lefty knuckleballer.
Oh, yeah.
Because one of the Sabre members wrote up a bio of him a couple years ago, and you should look into, I can't remember who it was, the name of the guy off the top of my head, but Dan Boone was somebody I remember from when he pitched with the Orioles and the Padres. And just the idea of this little guy, he was a little guy. He was only like 5'7", 150 pounds, but he made it to the majors on the strength of his knuckleball.
It'd be great to see another knuckleballer, you know, in 2026, 27.
That's another pet topic of mine.
Real quick, Roy, jumping on Amazon, I know that there are some, a book that's available that you're a part of, translated into English, The Alternate Universe of Baseball.
That sounds like one of the Sabre collections that we did on Cuba, because we have books, there's one on Venezuela too, and we have them translated into Spanish. There are Sabre members who are native Spanish speakers and are able to devote their efforts to producing a Spanish language edition.
Yeah, for any predominantly Spanish-speaking listeners here, Mini Minoso, Martin De Higo, Luis Tiant, El Duque, and Levon Hernandez. Just some of the great baseball figures profiled. This volume features 47 biographies in total, in addition to essays on Cuban baseball. Yeah, like you said, these biographies were researched and written by a team of Sabre members. The Bio Project has produced biographies of, I said, dozens credited to you, maybe hundreds, I'm not sure, more than 3,800 players since 2002.
It's upwards of 6,000 now.
Wow. I obviously can't thank you enough for appearing on the podcast, but Roy, thank you for the work that you and everyone at Sabre are doing to shed light on all these ball players and all the stories that maybe have yet to be told in many cases.
Well, nice to be appreciated, Dan. Thank you.
Okay, folks. Well, that's it for today. I'll have links in the episode notes to sabre.org, where you can learn more about the organization and have some information for you on Dan Bankhead. This has been a real joy. Thanks for listening to the Dan Time Podcast. Wherever you are out there, baseball is upon us. We are a few weeks away here. Here's to your favorite team. Everybody's 0-0, having a record year, and hopefully they don't have to go through the Dodgers if it's a National League team. Take care, everybody, and we'll see you next Sunday. That's what I used to say, or soon enough on the Dan Time Podcast. Thank you, Roy Costello.
Bye now.